Now, how do we read suttas? How do we come to an understanding of that which the Buddha taught? How do we, who are generally speaking, rather more worm-like, aspire to the wisdom of the Buddha and see things from that perspective? One of the characteristics, I believe, of the Buddha's teachings is that, on the whole, he tended to teach in a way that's quite aspirational. That is to say, he'd set a very high standard and he would call you out to try to live up to that standard. So when the Buddha talked about meditation, he very often talked about jhanas, talked about very deep and transformational insights. And sometimes it seems that, you know, we're sort of stuck here and there's these beautiful blue mountains off in the distance, but only a few of us will leave here and ascend to those mountains. The rest of us will be stuck in Parramatta, in Harris Park. Anyway, but I think you know what I mean. So can I ask again, how do we read the suttas? Now, one of the biggest, I think, problems or obstacles to people reading the suttas is what we might call the fallacy of premature relevancy. We might call it that. The fallacy of premature relevancy. What do I mean? What I mean is that people read the suttas and they say, what does it mean for me? How useful is it for me? Hands up, anyone who's read it and thought, hey, how is this useful for me? Yeah? See? You've all committed the fallacy of premature relevancy. Why on earth do you assume that it does have any relevance for you? Maybe it doesn't. The Buddha taught many things over his lifetime. Why do you assume that this particular thing is relevant for you? If the Buddha was here, you know, we can assume he would probably be able to find out what was relevant for you and teach you the teaching that you wanted to know. But the Buddha isn't here. You just got me. I don't know what's relevant for you. I just make this stuff up. Okay? So how do you do that? How do you find that out, right? Well, first thing you can do is drop that assumption that it is relevant for you. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but that's something that you can find out by learning from the sutta rather than imposing relevance on top of the sutta. What happens if you assume that it must be relevant for you is that rather than letting the teaching transform you, you transform the teachings. You bring everything in the teaching down to your own level because you assume that everything must be relevant to your level. Rather than letting the teaching to call you out to a higher level. Right? And so what we end up doing, if we keep asking, how is it relevant for me, is we end up dumbing everything down, reducing everything, watering everything down. It's okay if there are teachings that you don't understand. It's okay if there are things that maybe you do understand conceptually, but you haven't realized them yet. It's okay if there are high states of meditation attainments and your meditation's really crap, right? It's okay. Nobody expects you to be a great advanced spiritual sage. Maybe you are. Terrific. What the Buddha is saying is that there is a path and that we can take steps along that path. Right? That's all. So if something is something that we don't understand or is something that's obscure or difficult, accept that. Now, in this particular case, you know, we have this teaching on the five dreams, and of course we tend to read that through our own experience, our own knowledge of dreaming. We tend to read that through the various interpretations of dreaming that we might be familiar with. I mean, of course, these days we're very familiar with the psychological approach to dreaming, that it's speaking to us in some way of the unconscious. Of course, there are other takes on the dreaming, like the Aboriginal mythology of the dream time, and various other kinds of things which we can look at. Say prophetic dreams and so on. So one of the approaches that I always like to try to use is to try to destabilize my own assumptions. And one of the ways that we can destabilize our own assumptions is by stepping back into the Buddha's life or into the Buddha's time or even before the Buddha's time. And I believe that this is perhaps the single biggest failing in the way that we study and approach the suttas is that we don't pay attention to what came before the Buddha. And the whole Buddhist tradition is guilty of this and has been for 2,000 years. And we have assumed that the Buddha is talking to people like us. In other words, we assume that the Buddha is talking to Buddhists, whereas in fact a very large amount of the time Buddha is talking to people who aren't Buddhists. Right? So when we talk about things that came before the Buddha, then we have a very rather limited range of sources, but we do have some sources, and I would like to read one of those sources for you right now. If I can find it, and if I haven't gone and lost it. Okay, so this is a text called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Pretty sure it's a Brihadaranyaka. Let me just double check that. Yeah, it must be the Brihadaranyaka. Okay, so the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is one of a set of scriptures in the Brahmanical tradition written in Sanskrit and dating from about 100 or 200 years before the time of the Buddha in probability. So these texts, especially this text called Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, is, I believe, the most immediate and relevant literary context for the Buddha that we possess. There are other things which are also relevant, Jaina scriptures and various other things, but this one gives us a lot of things which are very, very similar to what the Buddha taught. We don't know the exact time and date of this collection, and in fact it must have been collected over some period of time, but the main sage in this collection, the Brihadaranyaka collects a number of different dialogues from different people. The main one here is Yajnavalkya, right? Yajnavalkya, don't be confused by the use of the G in italics. It's just an old orthographical convention. It just means it's just a modern spelling of Pali or Sanskrit. That would be a J. So there's just a different spelling because it's a very old text. So Yajnavalkya was a Brahmanical sage and philosopher who lived in the same area as the Buddha about 100 or 200 years prior. Okay? And here he's speaking to the king of Videha. And Videha, again, as anyone familiar with the suttas will know, is one of the regions where, or cities where the Buddha traveled to, and in that region. King Ajatasattu, for example, the famous king in Buddhism, is the Vedehikutta, the son of the Vedehin lady. And so this is like the immediate geographical and temporal context of the Buddha. In fact, Janaka, the king here, features in a number of Buddhist Jataka stories, and the city that he's in is called Janakpur, and it still exists on the map today in Uttar Pradesh. So this is a somewhat long dialogue, and so I'll just read through it pretty much straight to start with. Yajnavalkya came to Janaka Videha and did not mean to speak with him. Right? Lovely opening to this dialogue, right? So this is the sage who's coming to see this great king who he's met many times before, but he's just, I'm not going to talk. When formerly Janaka, Videha, and Yajnavalkya had a disputation on the Agnihotra, on the fire ceremony, Yajnavalkya had granted him a boon, and Janaka chose for a boon that he might be free to ask him any question he liked. Yajnavalkya granted it, and thus the king was the first to ask him a question. Yajnavalkya, what is the light of man? Yajnavalkya replied, "The sun, O king, for having the sun alone for his light, the man sits, moves about, does his work and returns." Janaka said, "So indeed it is, O Yajnavalkya." He then said, "But when the sun has set, what is then the light of man?" Yajnavalkya replied, "The moon indeed is his light. For having the moon alone for his light, man sits, moves about, does his work and returns." Janaka said, "So indeed it is, Yajnavalkya." Then he said, "When the sun has set and the moon has set, what then is the light of man?" Yajnavalkya replied, "Fire indeed is his light. For having fire alone for his light, a man sits, moves about, does his work and returns." When the sun has set, O Yajnavalkya, and the moon has set, and the fire has gone out, what then is the light of man? The Yajnavalkya really doesn't want to answer this question. The Yajnavalkya replied, "Sound indeed is his light. For having sound alone for his light, man sits, moves about, does his work, and returns. Therefore, O king, when one cannot see even one's own hand, yet when the sound is raised, one goes towards it." "So indeed it is, Yajnavalkya. But when the sun has set, and the moon has set, and the fire has gone out, and the sound has hushed, what then is the light of man?" So you can see the movement of this is moving from the brightness of day into the nighttime. The self, indeed, is his light. For having the self alone as his light, man sits, moves about, does his work, and returns. So, of course, this was the answer which he was looking for all along. Janaka then said, "Who is that self?" "He who is within the heart, surrounded by the pranas, the senses, the person of light, consisting of knowledge, he, remaining the same, wanders along the two worlds as if thinking, as if moving. During sleep, in the dream, he transcends this world and all the forms of death. On being born, that person, assuming his body, becomes united with all evils. And when he departs and dies, he leaves all the evils behind." Right? So this is the Brahmanical concept of the Atman. Right? So the Atman wanders through life, and that same Atman is that which wanders through dreams. When being born, then the Atman assumes this body and becomes united with the evils of this world, and then when he dies, he leaves it behind. There are two states for that person, the one here in this world, the one in the next world, and as a third, an intermediate state, the state of sleep. When in that intermediate state, he sees both these states together, this world and the next world. And whatever his admission to the other world may be, having gained that admission, he sees both the evils and the blessings. And when he falls asleep, then after having taken away with him the material from the whole world, destroying it and building it again, he dreams by his own light. In that state, a person is self-illuminated. Right? So in other words, the world that you live in when you're dreaming is a world that's purely created from your own light, i.e. your consciousness, i.e. your Atman, which they've already said is your own light. There are no real chariots in that state, no horses, no roads, but he himself creates chariots, horses, and roads. There are no blessings there, no happiness and no joys, but he himself creates blessings, happiness, and joys. There are no tanks there, no lakes, no rivers, but he himself sends forth tanks, lakes, and rivers. He indeed is the maker. Yeah. On this, there are the verses. So here the text of Brihadaranyaka is quoting from earlier verses. I'm not sure if it gives the place of those. It might be from the Rig Veda. Having subdued by sleep all that belongs to the body, he, not asleep himself, looks down upon the sleeping senses. Having assumed light, he goes again to his place, the golden person, the lonely bird. Evocative imagery, huh? The lonely bird. And you can see how this imagery is starting to reflect some of the imagery we've seen in the Buddha's dreams, right? The idea of the bird. Guarding with the breath the lower nest, the immortal moves away from the nest. That immortal one goes wherever he likes, the golden person, the lonely bird. So this is the self. Going up and down in the dream, the god makes manifold shapes for himself, either rejoicing together with women, or laughing with his friends, or seeing terrible sights. People may see his playground, but himself no one ever sees. Therefore they say, "Let no one wake a man suddenly, for it is not easy to remedy if he does not get back to his body." Huh? So when you're in your dream, yourself is out there and playing in the world, creating its own existence. And if you wake someone up suddenly, right? Well, I'm sure he would have drawn from the Upanishads. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Here in sleep, the person is self-illuminated. And then Janaka said, "I give to you, sir, 1,000. probably 1,000 cows. Speak on for the sake of my emancipation. Yajnavalkya said, that person, having enjoyed himself in that state of bliss, samprasada or deep sleep, having moved about and seeing both good and evil, hastened back again as he came to the place from where he started, the place of sleep, to dream. And whatever he may have seen there, he is not affected by it, for that person is not attached to anything. So it is indeed, Yajnavalkya, I give you another 1,000. Speak on for the sake of emancipation. That person, having enjoyed himself in the sleep, having moved about and seeing both good and evil, hastens back and is not affected by it. So these are repeating similar kind of ideas. In fact, as a large fish moves along the two banks of a river, the right and left, so does a person move along these two states, the state of sleeping and the state of waking. And as a falcon or any other swift bird, after he has roamed about here in the air, becomes tired and folding his wings is carried to his nest, so does that person hasten to that state where asleep he desires no more desires and dreams no more dreams. Right? Again, beautiful imagery. Huh? Coming, that's when you finish your dream, you come back. And when you go to that deep state of dreamless sleep, then there is no more desire and you have no more dreams. In the later Hindu Advaita philosophy, this state is called the Turiya, or the fourth state. That's waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep. And then the fourth state is even beyond all of those things. Sorry, the dreamless sleep is probably the third state, and then the fourth state is beyond all of those. There are in his it goes more talking about dreams. I won't go into all of this because it will take a little bit long. As you can see, it's a bit of a long dialogue. And when it is said there, he does not know, yet he is knowing, though he does not know. For knowing is inseparable from the knower because it cannot perish. But there is then no second, nothing else different from him that he could know. When in waking and dreaming there is, as it were, another, then can one see the other, one can smell the other, one can speak to the other, one can hear the other, one can think the other, one can touch the other, one can know the other. An ocean is that one seer without any duality. This is the Brahma world, O King. And so this is the true goal of their practice, is to realize that Atman, which is that Brahma world, that ocean, which is that full of bliss. And all other creatures live on a small portion of that bliss. But I won't go too much into the rest of it, but just I can't help but just mention a couple of things. Like if we see here this image, now as a heavy laden carriage moves along groaning, so does this corporeal self mounted by the intelligent self, the consciousness, move along groaning when a man is going to expire. If you've read the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, you'll know that this is exactly the image that the Buddha used just before he died. Yeah? I keep this body going like an old cart which is strapped together by straps. Yeah? Or this next image. Right? When it talks about a mango being separated from the stalk, yeah? This is exactly the image that the Buddha uses in the Brahmajala Sutta to talk about his own death. Yeah? So when we read the Upanishads and we read this language, you can't help but stumble. Almost every second sentence is stumbling across something which reminds you of something you find in the suttas in terms of the phrasing or the images or the ideas. And again, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that therefore they're the same. I'm saying that therefore they're drawing on a common body of ideas and languages. And clearly, the Buddha, in the choice of his languages, the way that he's talking about things, is responding to and discussing within this particular cultural context, this specific cultural context. It's imbued and soaking through the suttas all the time. And so if we want to deepen our understanding of the suttas, we have to deepen our understanding of the context within which the Buddha was talking. Now, here in this Upanishadic context, what's quite remarkable is a very deep philosophical significance, deep, not just philosophical significance, but deep spiritual significance that's given to the state of dreams. And this also is something that reminds me of the Aboriginal dream time, where there's also a very deep philosophical and spiritual significance given to the concept of dreams. as somebody who hasn't been born in that culture, I've always found it difficult to understand exactly what that means. Like, what exactly does the dream time mean? I once discussed this with a conference, and there was an Indigenous speaker there, and I asked him this. I said, what does dreaming mean when they're talking about the dream times? Is that just like a dream? Like, he said, yes, it's just like when you have a dream, then that's the dream time. Yeah. So I'm sure there probably are other interpretations of it as well. So it's also this in the Upanishads. What exactly do they mean when they talk about deep sleep? Do they really mean that when you fall asleep into a dreamless sleep that you're going to get enlightened? We could just all take some Vicodin or something and then just knock us. Somehow I don't think that's quite what it means, yeah? It's talking about something like slipping the bonds of the earth, right? Something about non-attachment and peace, something about finding a way to stillness and ending. And so there's something like that Buddhist idea of Nibbana in there. Right? I mean, it's not exactly the same, but you can see how it's kind of getting towards that same idea. So even though the Buddha never really used states of dreaming in that spiritual significant way, you can still see that it informs his teaching. Now, in fact, when the Buddha talked about what he regarded as spiritual teaching, he used the exact opposite metaphor, right? Bodhi, yeah, awakening, right? Literally awakening. And that's very prevalent throughout all the Buddhist imagery, yeah? And to my mind, then the choice of that metaphor is clearly meant in opposition to these Upanishadic ideas, right? The spiritual goal is not falling into a deep sleep. It's waking up. It's truly waking up. And again, just to be clear, within the Upanishads themselves, there's a complex range of different ways of talking about the spiritual path, and talking about it in terms of deep sleep is just one set of ideas and metaphors used for talking about the spiritual path, right? They also contain that way of awakening and clear knowledge and all of those things. So the Buddha was leaving behind this way of thinking about sleep and giving it some kind of spiritual significance. When we read that, or at least speak for myself, you know, when I read that passage on the Atman and the dreaming, even though I don't believe it as such, right? I don't believe that there is such a thing as an Atman, and I don't believe that when you go to sleep that there's a little self that goes out and plays in the world and so on, right? But it's a very beautiful set of ideas, isn't it? It's actually very rich and very insightful in sort of understanding how that process is. Yeah? And I think as, you know, for someone like myself, you know, as someone who follows the Buddhist tradition, it's important to understand that there are points of difference between what the Buddha was teaching and what we find in the Upanishads. But that's not to dismiss or to belittle, you know, that wisdom tradition, because there is a lot of wisdom and insight to that. And it was through that tradition, I believe, that the Buddha was, you know, led to advance and towards his own goal and his own spiritual practice. So anyway, that was just a few reflections that I'd like to offer on the Upanishadic background of dreams. Are there any questions on that, or anybody like to discuss that anymore? John? Sorry, Dana. Right. So in Buddhism, you have the idea of the mind-made-body, mano-maya-kaya, which is probably something similar, right? Yeah. Actually, in the Upanishadic tradition, the Brahmanical tradition, they had many different conceptions of the self or the Atman, right? And so that mano-maya-kaya would be one kind of way of thinking of the self or the Atman. And it was philosophers like Yajnavalkya who then started to move beyond that. And he would say that even that is not the self. Yeah? Yajnavalkya, when he was pressed, to say neti, neti, not that. Yeah? But mind made body, that's exactly what it's saying here, right? Is that all of this world in your dream, you see, is made by your mind. Yeah. John.
Right.
Right. Right, but I mean, Vedanta draws very directly on the Upanishads, so yeah. Right. Good. Yeah. If anybody, you should, it's on the Sacred Texts Archive, and it's a very readable text. Some of it gets a bit long, talking about ritual stuff, but a lot of it is very readable, so I encourage. Unfortunately, yes, the freely available translations are the older ones, yeah. Yep, that's true. Yeah, that's a popular one. Yeah, that. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that kind of view is very popular from modern. In this kind of modern, that's a standard view in modern Hinduism, and say that the Buddha was an incarnation of Vishnu, and we can say that even the imagery that we saw, that there are parallels there for sure. So, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. To be honest, those kinds of things, they're a bit of double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's harmonious and it's nice, and I'm quite happy to, you know, point out the similarities. At the same time, no Buddhist has ever considered themselves to be that Buddhism is Hinduism, right? We've always believed that we're practicing a distinctly different path, not out of any disrespect, but that's our point of view. So Hindus come along and say, actually, you've really been Hindus all along. We're like, yeah. Well, exactly, yeah. Except the Buddha wasn't a Hindu. Yeah, but Jesus certainly was a Jew, and he probably never wanted to create a Christianity. Do you want to create Christianity? I don't think so. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. So these people are talking in a context, right? And same thing. Same. Jesus was addressing the conditions he saw around them, speaking to those people there, and addressing the problems that he saw there. And of course, there's lessons we can draw from that, but we can't just assume that our problems are the same problems that he was talking about. And it's the same with the Buddha. You know, he was talking about universal human problems, no doubt about that. Yeah? And so we can see a lot in there of our own things. Right? At the same time, we just have to be conscious about what those differences are. So in that notion of the self and the dreams that's talked about here, you know, we don't really have that kind of psychologizing idea of the dreams, right? Like that idea that the dream is an expression of your unconscious. But it's more that the dream is, it's more interpreted metaphysically that the dream is an expression of your eternal self. But it's quite evocative, isn't it? That way it's kind of withdrawing from the brightness of day, step by step by step, into the night, and then that's where you see your own creative self. Mm. So I mentioned before about those similarities with Buddha and Vishnu here, just a couple of images. This is here on the right. So, of course, this is, you've seen this very common images of the Buddha with Nagas. There's probably some around here. Are there any around here? Can't see any. But they're very common. And, of course, Vishnu with the Nagas as well. There's another one, the Buddha with Naga. And so I'm getting more into, at the moment, who should it's the last half an hour now. Would you prefer to break up into groups and have some discussion, or would you prefer to stay in one group and have a discussion with everybody here? Because one group is better? Okay. Because I've finished the main sort of presentation part that I wanted to present, so now is a more discussion part. But I'll just sort of throw out a couple more reflections as we go on. This is a paper which I came across, which gives a art depiction of these five dreams. And as I mentioned at the beginning, the dreams are not a kind of very common part of the Buddhist tradition. But, you know, we do find them mentioned a number of times, and not all that frequently in artwork. According to this article, we don't find them in any Indian artwork. What about in Sri Lanka? Does anybody know of any Sri Lankan depictions of these dreams? I can't recall any. I mean, I'd be surprised if there wasn't one somewhere, right? There's lots of temples in Sri Lanka with lots of drawings in them. But, certainly not very common. But this particular one is from Pagan. And I'll just see if it gives you the history of the thing. This is just the history of the Bodhisattva. So according to various of the Buddha biographies, the five dreams were considered to be made in the night of the great departure, so the night that he went forth from home, rather than just before his enlightenment. Okay. So two traditions. In the northern tradition, dreams happened when he left home, and in the southern tradition, it happened on the night of his enlightenment. Which we actually would agree with Mahavastu, where the dreams were shared with his family, or his family had dreams as well. Right, yeah. That's right, yeah. That's also, that one's very common in right across the traditions, and that's depicted a lot, yeah. Okay. So these are from a place called Mong Yonggu, around AD 1271. It's a somewhat significant date. AD 1271 was around the time that Buddhism in Myanmar was reformed to follow the Sri Lankan Mahavihara tradition that we call Theravada these days. Previously, Burma had followed a number of different Buddhist traditions. So perhaps this painting was one of the works that was done at that time. Unfortunately, the paintings themselves are not that clear. Here we can see an image with the Buddha, and it's fairly straightforward, right? The Buddha sitting there, clear enough. And just down the bottom is the Buddha lying with the creeper coming out of his belly button. Nabi. Oh, I should have mentioned actually one nice little detail in the Pali which you can't capture in translation. The word for belly button is Nava, or Nabi, and the word for sky is also Nava. So they both have the same name. So basically saying, that, again, that idea of connection of the individual self down here with the sky, with the infinite. And so that's an expansion of that same picture. And you see this creeper coming up. So I think even the fact that we have to look for such a obscure and sort of poorly preserved image is an example of how rare these are. Right. Pranika, yeah, right. Well spotted, yes. So prana and prana basically means breath. Yeah, and so in Buddhism, in Buddhism, prana and usually means breath, and by derivation, it means breathing things. So prana is a breathing thing, or a living thing, or a creature, and pranika is just another variant on that. Actually, pranika just means a little creature. So that's what that means. But in the Upanishads, prana has a rather more specific or sort of drawn out philosophical meaning. It does mean breath, and it means breath in the sense that, like in modern Hinduism, they'll talk about prana as being the kind of energy, so that actually uses it in that way, but also often has meaning more like senses. And so that's why it was translated in that way. So it has to be understood in context. Yeah, but again, that's an interesting usage in the Upanishads, which you don't find in the suttas. In the suttas, prana always just means breath, it never means the senses. So here's another picture, the Buddha lying down, and here, it's not quite sure, but it's believed that these may represent the birds that have flown in from the four directions that are coming to see the Buddha. So this would be another depiction of that dream. Thirteenth century. Yeah. And this is another one. And here, yeah, I'm not sure if they're the same birds. There's birds all around. That might just be decorative. 172. Yeah. So I don't want to go through this whole essay, but I just wanted to just show you some examples of those images. And then it goes on to give the sources, the different some different texts and sources for those images from different texts. Yeah, I don't think they drew them. They should have done, right? So, yeah, this is you can. That's the title of that paper. If you're interested to read it in some more detail. Yeah, and this. Well, it's a bit like Jack and the Beanstalk, right? Right? Yeah, going up into the sky? Yeah. Why grass? Why not? I mean, grass in India can be pretty impressive, right? So you can have, like, you know, the grass can be tall enough to hide an elephant. Yeah. So I guess it means like some kind of grass or creeper or something like that. Yeah. Right. Good point. A caterpillar is going from the feet to the knees. What do you think? Okay. Yeah, yeah. Anybody? I'm not sure, actually. I've never. Sorry? Yeah, although it's not he's not necessarily in the same posture in every dream, right? So the dreams aren't necessarily the same thing, yeah? But yeah, in the one where he is lying, then it's in the water. Only going to his knees, right? Maybe. You do find, I mean, I'm not sure if it's related, but you do find in the Jaina imagery, when they depict their teacher, Mahavira, because one of the things that the Jains used to do was to stand for a long time. And to show that in the sculpture, they'll have creepers like growing up around their legs, up to their knees. I don't know if that's related. I think so. So yes, I think we discussed that a bit before, but yes, I assume that the caterpillars are there to transform into butterflies. It's not explicitly mentioned, and we don't actually, I mean, curiously enough, we don't really find that imagery used sort of explicitly. I mean, you'd think it would be, right? Right? It's very powerful imagery, but we don't actually find that, and certainly not in the Buddhist texts, as far as I know. Early. Yeah, it's commonly mentioned in the suttas, so it was obviously already an existing custom at that time. It really is pointing to that same thing, that expansion of consciousness, yeah? And it's a very powerful imagery for that. So the dreamless state. I'm not quite sure what you're asking. You're talking about in the sutta or in the Upanishads or in real life? Yeah. Again, I'm not quite sure when you say attainment of dreamless situation. It doesn't mention that in the sutta. So what exactly are you referring to? Are you talking about in the Buddhist teaching? Are you talking about, I'm not quite clear what you're asking. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Is that what you're asking? Are you asking, do arahants still have dreams? Is that what you're asking? Yeah? You sure? You looked a bit uncertain for a minute there. Yes, slightly unclear. The Buddha doesn't talk about having dreams after this, so this is occurring before his enlightenment. And then subsequently he doesn't really talk about having dreams. Having said which, I mean, he doesn't talk much about dreams at all, so not sure how significant that is. And as far as I know, there's nowhere in the Buddhist doctrine that actually says something either way, or one way or the other. And so, you could say that if the dreams come from the unconscious, right, from things that are unknown, then an arahant is fully known their own mind, and so they don't have an unconscious anymore. It's all conscious, right? So from that point of view, then you could say, well, maybe they don't. Arahants don't dream. On the other hand, you could also argue that the state of dreaming is itself a state of delusion, right? Because in the dream, you see things that aren't really there. Yeah? So again, you could argue that the arahant doesn't have dreams for that reason. So I'm not really sure, and the suttas aren't really definitive on it. But I think it is quite commonly said or believed that a fully enlightened person would not have dreams. But I'm not 100% sure whether that's actually correct. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Stuff to get rid of. Yeah, they probably have bigger dustbins than the rest of us, yeah? I mean, the two things are not mutually exclusive, right? I mean, the contents of your dustbin probably tells you quite a lot about your unconscious mind if you were to look at it closely, right? So, yeah. I mean, I tend to be a bit skeptical of reductive theories of dreaming. I think dreaming is probably, as such a widespread thing, it probably serves a number of different functions, you know? And, I think to dismiss or to discount the wisdom of so many people over so many years who have seen that there actually is something significant in dreams is, I think, I feel it's a bit reductive, a bit dismissive. Yeah. Which is not to say that everything in dreams is significant. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, would it be one of the Sure, why not? He's teaching the monks, right? So it begins up by addressing the monks. Bhikkhave. Yeah? Yeah, I mean, it was remembered in the community and it was passed down. And exactly the context, exactly the context, we don't really know. But yeah, I think the main point is it's not something which is just somebody read the Buddha's mind or something, but it is actually something that he taught. Yeah. Yeah. For whatever reason. Why do you think that the Buddha taught this? Like you can see that there are Dhamma teachings in there, right? Okay, so that's fine. There are Dhamma teachings in there. He talks about his enlightenment. He even talks about the cosmic significance of it. He talks about people going for refuge and many of those things. So that's all fine. So I can understand that there are Dhamma teachings there. But it's also true that those same Dhamma teachings are taught in many other places, in a much more straightforward way. So why do you think that they're taught in this place in this way? What's why? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sure, yeah. The Buddha always referred to himself in third person. It's a kind of normal feature of the suttas. Yeah. And so when a sutta begins like this, just by saying bhikkhave, then this means it's taught by the Buddha. So it's not taught by Ananda. What he was referring to there was the fact that according to the tradition, Ananda was the memorizer of the teachings. So he would remember the teachings and pass them down. But when he remembered the teachings and passed them down, he didn't pass them down from his point of view. He just memorized the teachings and repeated them. Yeah? So, yeah. Mendicant means bhikkhus. Yeah? Bhikkhu means someone who wanders for alms. Yeah? Bhikkha is the alms food. And so this is the word bhikkhave. And so when I translated that, I translated it as mendicant. No, the beginning is just dropped off just for abbreviation. It's not really significant because it's just if they'd done these on computers in the old days, they would have put them all in there because they had lots of hard disk space. But they didn't. They had to copy them out by hand. So they kind of used various techniques for compressing the data, including leaving out bits that they didn't need. Yes, sorry, but Barbara was there. Sorry, yes, sorry, that was exactly what Deepika just asked. Yeah, sorry, I should have repeated the question because then otherwise people, not everyone hears. In the classical presentation of a sutta, let me just give this, okay, since a couple of questions on this. Classical presentation of a sutta, we find that the Buddha begins, and I'll begin with the very first sutta in the Digha Nikaya, why not? The Buddha begins by saying, or the sutta begins by saying, evam me sutang. And the reason that it says that, okay, is to introduce and to give the setting of the text. So here we have the Brahma Jala Sutta, and it begins by saying, Eva me sutang, so I have heard. At one time the Buddha was traveling along the road between Rajagaha and Nalanda together with a large sangha of about 500 mendicants. Okay, and so on and so forth. So these words, Eva me sutang, and the setting are like a kind of a wrapping for the sutta, like a beginning and an ending. And they give it some context. And the words, so I've heard, traditionally believed to have been spoken by Venerable Ananda in the first council when he recollected the texts. However, that is not possible. And why? Because the word evam me sutang is a specific idiom in Pali that has a specific meaning. And what evam me sutang means is, this is something that has been passed down in the oral tradition. And it's quite distinct from the words that you use when you are actually present. If you are actually present to hear the Buddha, you would say, Sammukha me bhagavato sutang, sammukha pigahitang. Face to face with the Buddha, I heard this. Face to face, I learned it. Right? And this is explicitly contrasted in the suttas by evam me sutang. For example, when somebody reports an event and somebody says to them, it seems that you say, occurs in a context where a monk is talking about his visits to the heaven realms. And somebody says, I notice that when you talk about your visits to the heaven realms, you don't say, evam me sutang. You don't say, I've heard this from someone else. So therefore, I assume that you must have been there yourself. Okay? So this eva me sutang specifically means that you were not present at the events, but you heard it passed down from someone else. Obviously, Venerable Ananda was in fact present at many of the teachings, not all of them, but many of the teachings. So he would not have introduced the suttas by saying, so I heard. In fact, when Ananda does introduce suttas that he heard from the Buddha, he used that other idiom that I just mentioned. Face to face with the Buddha, I heard this. Face to face, I learnt it. Okay. So what that means is that Evamesuttang is a note which is remarking that this is something which has been passed down through the oral tradition. So it wasn't the words of Ananda at the first council. And so these, technically, Evamesuttang should be included at the beginning of every sutta, and every sutta should end with the person that the sutta was addressed to rejoicing in what was said. Although in practice, these are often omitted. So in longer or more significant suttas, or the suttas at the start of a collection, they're there, but then very often they just get dropped off. And that's merely for the purpose of convenience, because these were all written by hand in ola leaf manuscripts, and the doing that is very expensive. And you have to pay somebody to actually sit there and scribe these things and make the ola leaf and keep them all. So they tended to abbreviate them. And in fact, all the Buddha scriptures from Pali, Chinese, Sanskrit, and Tibetan, all of them have these kinds of abbreviations. Okay, let me see if I can remember one. I think I can. Well, I'm not saying it wasn't reported by Ananda. I'm saying that the words Evamesuttang do not mean that. Whether it's supported by Ananda or not, I cannot say.
Never thought of that.
Let me get back. It's not so kind of definitive. I mean, there are cases where Ananda did see something and then said, "This is what I've heard," right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that every sutta has to have that. Let me just see. Okay, so this is a time when the monks are sitting around talking about the Buddha, and the Buddha comes in. It's a bit awkward, right? So they're sitting around saying, "Oh, the Buddha's like this, the Buddha's like that," and then the Buddha shows up. Right? Okay, what do you do? So the Buddha says, "What are you talking about?" "Oh, we were just talking about you, actually." He says, "Well, keep on talking about me. Talk about my incredible, amazing qualities." The Buddha didn't have a problem with self-confidence. So this is now Ananda continuing. "Sir, I have heard and learned this in the presence of the Buddha. Sammukha me tang bhagante bhagavato sutang sammukha pigahitang." And then he's quoting from another sutta. And that sutta that he's quoting from is, in fact, the Digha Nikaya number 15. So it is an actual sutta that he's quoting from. Yeah, so this is, and this idiom we find a number of times. It's not that common, but we do find it a number of times. Yeah. All right. So look, we're getting, are there any other questions? Otherwise, we should wrap up about now. Okay, so I'm just going to very briefly sum up for today. Today we looked at the sutta, Anguttara Nikaya number 5.196 on the five great dreams of the Bodhisattva. And these were five dreams which were had by the Buddha to be, either on the night of his going forth or on the eve of his enlightenment, and which were later recollected by him and taught to the monks. And these five dreams each symbolize a different aspect of his awakening and an aspect of his community and what happened to him after that happened. And the dreams have a number of different points of connection and resonance, both with the ancient Indian culture and with the way that we see and experience dreams ourselves. And so it gives an opening for looking into suttas from that point of view of looking for something that's symbolic and something that's evocative, rather than something that's necessarily doctrinal and rational. And so to me, that's That's interesting because it allows a kind of imaginative and creative approach to the suttas, which we don't find in the more doctrinally orientated places. I don't think that, you know, I don't think that with this brief presentation this afternoon that we can exhaust the meaning of these suttas and these dreams and these images, but I hope that we've at least been able to somehow express or to show that there are these depths and these dimensions to the suttas which we're not necessarily aware of, and hopefully inspire you to have a look closer and to be open to looking at different ways of seeing things, and especially to that idea that we should always try to question and undermine our own assumptions when reading things. And when reading a sutta, something like dreams, our initial assumption would be to read that through a modern psychological perspective of seeing it as something unconscious, whereas in fact the people at that time would have been perhaps more used to seeing it from a philosophical or metaphysical perspective as being the experiences of the self when it's left the body. So that's a brief summary of this afternoon's discussion. Now, before we break up, allow me to just say a couple of short things. Number one, we will be having 3 more of these sutta classes. Please come. Dates on the Buddhist Library website. Dates up here. Buddhist Library website. Okay. Meanwhile, lots of other great stuff. Okay, yeah, next month, 14th of April. Lots of other great stuff here at the Buddhist Library. Come and enjoy it. Especially cleaning out the mental clutter. Marie Kondo of Buddhism. Does it spark joy? Just throwing it out is what sparks joy in me, usually. At that. Now, this coming week, on the Wednesday, the 13th, there will be a very special meeting at the Sydney Uni. We're meeting with Dr. Mark Allen and with the Sri Lankan High Consul to talk about a proposal to have the Pali Canon inscribed in the UNESCO Register of, what is it called? Memory of the World, right? UNESCO Register of Memory of the World. So this is a very, very significant initiative by the Sri Lankan government. And which we're very delighted to support. So if you want to learn a bit about this and to learn a bit about the historical significance of the Pali Canon, then at Sydney Uni, 6 o'clock for a 7 o'clock start at the F23 building at Sydney Uni, F23, all right, Wednesday the 13th, coming up. All right. Other events that you should know about, we are at the Friday nights at the Harris Park Community Centre, 7 p.m. You're all welcome. We will be doing a retreat at Uluru over this Easter, so if you are interested in that, please talk to Deepika. And what else? Oh, the Buddhist mythology course is coming up in a month or two, in May. And is that it? Sorry? Oh, Monday morning meditation. Any of you in the Parramatta area, come down to Queen's Wharf Reserve at 6 a.m. on Monday morning. What? What are you laughing at? It's great. You're thinking that's ridiculous. You've already been meditating for 3 hours. Okay, so Monday morning, 6 a.m., and also if you are in the area as well, at 11:30 every day we're going for Pindavata, for alms round, on Wigram Street in Harris Park. So if you come around and want to give alms to the monks, then come along. I think that's it.